This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In late January 21, Sandra Birchmore texted a friend about Matthew Farwell. He'd come to her apartment the night before. He brought her ginger ale. Her friend texted back, "He's coming around." Sandra believed the man who had been exploiting her since she was 15, possibly younger, was finally softening, finally accepting the pregnancy, finally choosing her, even a little. She imagined a version of a future where Farwell would be part of their child's life, or whatever twisted connection they had built over a decade might become something resembling a family. Within days, Sandra would be dead. The ginger ale wasn't a peace offering. It was the last time she would interpret cruelty as kindness. This is part two of our five-part series on the Sandra Birchmore case. In part one, we told you how Sandra entered the Stoughton Police Explorers program at 12 years old and was groomed and exploited by multiple officers over the span of a decade. Now we're inside the final month of her life. The pregnancy, the escalation, and the warning that should have saved her. To understand the final month of Sandra's life, you have to understand what December 2020 meant for Matthew Farwell. Sandra learned she was pregnant. She told Farwell he was the father, and the walls of his carefully compartmentalized life started caving in. Farwell was already a father of two. His wife was pregnant with their third child. He was a Stoughton police detective, the patrol officers' union president, a former soldier. He had built a public identity that depended entirely on Sandra Birchmore remaining invisible. Her pregnancy made that impossible. According to the superseding federal indictment, the baby Sandra was carrying was a boy, gestational age between 8 and 10 weeks at the time of her death. She was barely into the first trimester, and her whole world was reorganizing around this child. Sandra wasn't treating the pregnancy like a secret. That's important. She wasn't hiding. She wasn't ashamed. She made a poster to celebrate the pregnancy and sent Farwell a photo of it. She told friends, coworkers, and family members that he was the father. She was working as a teacher's assistant at an elementary school in Sharon, spending her days helping other people's children while preparing for one of her own. She was taking nursing courses at Massillot Community College. She was building towards something real. She was doing it openly. Sandra Birchmore, at 23 years old, was not a woman in crisis. She was a woman making plans. And that is precisely what made her dangerous to Matthew Farwell. Because Farwell was making plans too, not the kind that Sandra had imagined. According to witness statements gathered by federal investigators, Farwell made comments in the weeks before Sandra's death that in hindsight read like warnings nobody understood in the time. He told one person that if Sandra didn't end the pregnancy, he would take care of the problem himself. He told another person he needed to put crazy back in the bag. A former coworker told the FBI that about 2 weeks before Sandra died at their relationship, when he was at a restaurant and mentioned having problems with a woman other than his wife. When a coworker asked if they could help, Farwell said the problem was going to take care of itself. Three different people. Three different conversations, all pointing towards a man who saw a pregnant woman not as a human being carrying his child, but as a loose end that needed to be tied off. Sandra was talking to people, and every person she told was another crack in the wall Farwell had built between his public life and the decade of exploitation he'd been hiding. She told friends about her relationship with Farwell. She told coworkers he was the father of her child. But here's the detail that federal prosecutors say reframes the entire motive. Sandra wasn't just confiding in friends. She had contacted lawyers. And according to prosecutors, Sandra was developing a plan to obtain financial support for her child. She was exploring her legal options, and most critically, evidence indicates she was prepared to disclose that Farwell had abused and exploited her when she was underage. Sandra wasn't just going to name Farwell as the father. She was preparing to disclose the criminal conduct against her. the years, all of it, that started when she was 15. And she was 20 now. 23. And had, according to prosecutors, become assertive and resistant to his manipulation after learning she was pregnant. She was willing to use her role as a victim of Farwell's crime to ensure that she and her unborn child would be financially secure. For the first time in decades, Sandra was starting to understand her own leverage. She was starting to understand that what happened to her wasn't a relationship, it was a crime. And she was preparing to say so out loud to people with the authority to act on it. For Matthew Farwell, this was not a manageable situation. This was not an uncomfortable conversation or an embarrassing revelation. If Sandra went to lawyers and disclosed all of this, he was looking at criminal charges, an end to his career, the destruction of his marriage, and prison. Every thread of his carefully managed life was pulling loose at the same time. The pregnancy was the fuse. Sandra's willingness to talk was the match. And on January 20th, 2021, someone lit it. 11 days before Sandra's death, her friend picked up the phone and called the Stoughton Police Department. She told the department employee that Matthew Farwell was in a inappropriate relationship with her. It was exactly the kind of call that should trigger an internal alarm. An outside person reporting that a detective in the department was involved with a woman he'd known since she was a child in the department's own youth program in any functioning institution. That call goes to internal affairs. It gets documented. It gets investigated. It becomes a file that protects the person being victimized. Not in Stoughton. Nope. It's not how they do things there. That's not what happened. What happened is one of the most damning details in the entire case. The department employee who received the call told Matthew Farwell about it, went directly to the guy that the complaint's about. The one institution that should have protected Sandra instead hand-delivered the warning to the man federal prosecutors say took her life. They didn't open an investigation. They didn't flag it for a supervisor. They didn't contact Sandra. They told Farwell that someone was talking, and 11 days later, Sandra was dead. Think about the position Sandra was in during those final days and how cruel the contrast is between her reality and her perception. She'd been exploited by Farwell since she was 12. She was carrying a baby that she believed was his. She was contacting lawyers. She was telling the truth to people in her life. And the one time someone who loved her tried to report it to authorities, the authorities gave her abuser the heads up. Every safety net that should have existed for Sandra Birchmore had a hole in it. Every hole led back to the same department that was supposed to protect people like her. The timeline compresses fast after January 20th. Sandra continued going to work at the elementary school in Sharon. She continued texting friends. She was still making plans for the baby. She was texting about baby supplies, thinking about what came next, operating under the belief that Farwell was coming around. The ginger ale visit reinforced that belief. She had no reason to think the walls were closing in because from where she stood, things were looking up. Consider the cruelty of that asymmetry. Sandra was living in a version of reality where things were getting better. She was surrounded by small signs of progress. Farwell was visiting. She was making plans. She had a support system forming around her pregnancy, even if it was fragile. She had no way of knowing that her friends called the Stoughton Police Department. The one act of advocacy that should have triggered her protection had instead been routed directly to the man who posed the greatest danger to her. Sandra was operating without the most critical piece of information in her life. That the system she still believed in had already betrayed her one final time. Farwell saw the situation from the opposite angle. The circle of people who knew about Sandra was expanding every day. A formal complaint had been made to his department, and he knew about it because they told him. Sandra was talking to attorneys. His wife was about to have their third child. Every thread of his carefully managed double life was pulling loose at once. During the 8 years he had been grooming Sandra According to prosecutors, Farwell engaged in multiple extramarital affairs with other adult women. But he worked much harder to keep his relationship with Sandra a secret than any of the others. She was different. She represented criminal exposure, not just personal embarrassment. And now she was talking. According to prosecutors, he planned what happened next well in advance. Here's a detail from this period that prosecutors included in their filings that speaks to Sandra's state of mind. She had made a request for a key to her apartment from Farwell about a week before she died. According to the FBI, Farwell had a key. He had access to her home. The man who would allegedly kill her could walk in any time he chose. Sandra gave him that access because she still trusted him. Because despite everything, despite the decade of exploitation, despite the fact that he had taken so much from her, despite the fact that he was married with children, Sandra still believed Farwell was part of her life, not a threat to it. That trust was the final thing he exploited. February 1st to 21, surveillance cameras at Sandra's apartment building in Canton, a complex called Windsor Woods, captured her walking in and out of the building during the afternoon. She was wearing the clothes she'd had on all day. She was living an ordinary day, running errands, moving through the world the way you do when you have no idea it's the last time. That evening at 9:27 p.m., the cameras captured someone else entering the building. Matthew Farwell walked into the lobby and stepped onto the elevator at 9:56 p.m. He walked back out 29 minutes later. When Sandra's body was discovered 3 days later on February 4th, she was wearing the same clothes she wore on February 1st. She had not changed. She had not gone out again. She had not moved from that night. Her colleagues at the elementary school in Sharon had raised the alarm after she missed consecutive days of work. Sandra was reliable. She showed up. When she stopped showing up, the people who worked with her knew something was wrong. Police responded to a wellness check and found her in the apartment she had moved into with Farwell's help. In the building where she had been trying to build an independent life, she was 3 months pregnant with a baby boy she had already started planning for. Sandra Birchmore was never seen alive again after Matthew Farwell walked into her building at 9:27 p.m. on February 1st, 2021. What happened inside the apartment, inside those 29 minutes, is the subject of our next chapter. But what you should carry into that chapter is the knowledge that Sandra spent her final days hopeful. She was planning a life. She was fighting for her child. She was contacting lawyers to secure her future and her baby's future. She believed the man who had controlled her for a decade was finally choosing her, finally accepting the pregnancy, finally becoming the person she had spent 10 years hoping he would be. She was wrong about that. She was right about everything else. Sandra knew what had been done to her. She was ready to name it, and that, according to federal prosecutors, is why she is dead. In part three, we go inside those 29 minutes. The surveillance footage, the DNA on the murder weapon, the clavicle injury that didn't match the staged one, the broken necklace tangled in Sandra's hair, and the drunken reenactment that may be the most chilling detail in the entire case. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. It's coming up next in our series. If you want to get a full grasp on what this case is about, what happened from start to finish, this 5-part series we're putting out this week is the best place to do that. So press subscribe and don't miss it. We're putting them all out for you this week, and hopefully you can get a better understanding as we get closer to the trial. Give us your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.